So it's nice to see you all are still here. First days of retreat are often tough, and especially so many of you have traveled from across the country. And I can tell you from experience that jet lag lasts a few days, in my case anyway. So not surprising if some of you are feeling tired today and took it a little easier on yourself. And of course, those of you who have been practicing, you'll just ramp up and show everybody what the real thing is, right? Anyway, we're all easing in into the retreat now. Just one announcement before I start. If you haven't seen it yet, we will begin the one-to-one meetings tomorrow. And I put a list on the board for the people whom I'll be meeting with tomorrow. So please check that this evening if you haven't already. And what we've done is to divide the group into three. So there will be 10 people who will be meeting with on each of the interview days. It'll become clearer as we go along. But everyone should be seen in these first 3 days, the next 3 days of meetings. Okay, so tonight I'd like to talk about mindfulness of breathing. And this is such a interesting topic because it is the one practice, the only practice I know of that is offered in all the three main meditative schools in the Buddhist tradition. So obviously it's offered in Theravada, it's offered in Zen, both Rinzai and Soto, and it's offered in all the schools of Tibetan Buddhism. And I don't know of any other meditation practice that is common to all the major schools. So there's something quite special about mindfulness of breathing. And especially within our tradition, it is the premier meditation practice over the last 2,500 years. With all the senior Vipassana teachers that I've practiced with and learned from, all of them emphasized mindfulness of breathing. They not only taught it, they made it somewhat central in the way that they taught meditation. So we are in the stream of a very strongly established lineage, many lineages, in practicing mindfulness of breathing. And one of the reasons is that because it is such a refuge. When it is undertaken, cultivated, and developed, it is such a refuge. It's really a blessing. And I was just reflecting today that all of us, have recently come from the wider world into this very special retreat environment. And coming from the wider world, you all know that a refuge is needed because the winds of samsara are blowing as strongly and with as much difficulty now as ever in my lifetime. I won't go into the details because some of you don't know them, but the level of violence in the country, racially tinged, has continued. The climate crisis that we're facing is not being solved on the level that it needs to be solved at. COVID cases are rising, really across the country. The war in Ukraine, which I think all of you probably by now know about, is not winding down. And the political world is ineffective and getting more so. So if we look on I would say, the societal level, from my perspective, there's not a lot of good news. But if I look on the individual level, I see a lot of good news. I see a lot of growth in the Dharma, both individually, in people that I'm in contact with, and in the society as a whole. I see it making inroads and becoming more popular. So, on an individual basis, there's a lot of hope for us. I feel a lot of optimism about all of you and us, finding refuge through these practices. And if we can find refuge and clarity and some stability in a time like this, then I think we're doing well. We're obviously not in the most difficult situation in the world. There are wars in Ukraine and beyond. But given the general lack of stability and the rising level of violence and racism in the country, if we can find some mental stability within that and offer that stability to others in our circles, I think that's a real contribution. So that's something that I think is possible. And it's why one of the reasons why I so much appreciate a place like this, because we can find some peace of heart, peace of mind, and take that back into the world. So just to remember that we're not just practicing for ourselves, but to the extent that we can open and clear our own hearts and minds, that is a very big and perhaps rare gift to be able to take back and offer to the world. So our practice isn't just about getting quiet here, but it's about tapping deep reservoirs of understanding and compassion, and then offering those back into the world. It's the refuge that we find, and we ourselves can become a refuge to others. So although as we enter more and more into the silent retreat space, we will probably talk less and less about the specific events of the world. But please know that Sally and I are carrying those and care a lot about them, and are not forgetting the role of meditation within the broader social setting that we find ourselves in. The ripples from each of us will go out, have gone out before, will continue to go out, and we never know how far they'll reach. So I hope you'll remember that too, that your practice is to benefit others, and in the broadest sense, to benefit the whole world. May it be so. So in this section of the retreat especially, we are really dropping into a very powerful tradition that's 2,500 years old when we take up mindfulness of breathing. The development of this practice goes back not only to the Buddha's teachings, but to the Buddha's own practice, as I'll mention later. There are two main places that he talked about this in the discourses. One is in, you know, the cornerstone of the Vipassana world, which is the discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 10. Mindfulness of the body is the first foundation, and mindfulness of breathing is the first part of the first foundation. That's how fundamental it was in the Buddha's teachings. The second place that you probably know about is Majjhima Nikaya 118, which is the Anapanasati Sutta, the discourse on the mindfulness of breathing, where the Buddha gives detailed instructions on how to practice with the breath for many, many benefits. The Buddha wasn't keen on giving a huge number of explicit meditation instructions. Despite 45 years of teaching, despite basically 20 volumes of his translated words in English, specific meditation instructions don't occur all that often. And so for mindfulness of breathing to be so central in these two suttas is quite a strong statement. And in the talk tonight, I'd like to go into why that is. And to get into it, I want to talk about mindfulness in general, and then mindfulness of the body, and then some details on mindfulness of breathing and some suggestions. So the first thing I want to highlight is the question, what do we mean by mindfulness? You know, it's everywhere now in society. Mindfulness-based stress reduction has gone all over the country and in other countries as well, and gone into hospitals and therapeutic settings and many treatment facilities. when I was beginning my practice here a lot of years ago, I would never have imagined that there would be a magazine called Mindful. And yet, you know, there it is, on newsstands, mindfulness on newsstands. Wow. And yet, if somebody asked you to define mindfulness, could you come up with something? Yeah, okay, that's good. You know, let's say your mother or father or one of your kids tapped you on the shoulder and said, I hear you're doing this stuff called mindful. What is it? So I've heard a lot of different definitions of mindfulness. And most of them seem to me a little too complicated. So I want to read a section from the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the Buddha's main discourse on mindfulness practice. And it's in your study guide. If you are interested in following along, it's on page 3, excerpts from the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. I want to read just a few lines from each foundation. So this is from the first foundation on the body. Breathing in long, one knows I breathe in long. Breathing out long, one knows I breathe out long. When walking, one knows I am walking. When standing, one knows I am standing. Okay. Second foundation, which is on Vedana, or feeling. When feeling a pleasant feeling, one knows I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling an unpleasant feeling, one knows I feel an unpleasant feeling. Okay. Third foundation, which is on mind or mind states. Here one knows a lustful mind to be lustful, and a mind without lust to be without lust. One knows an angry mind to be angry, and a mind without anger to be without anger. Okay, fourth foundation, which is dhammas, or I like to translate it as dhammic principles. If sensual desire is present in one, one knows there is sensual desire in me. If sensual desire is not present in one, one knows there is no sensual desire in me. So these are excerpts from all four foundations in the Satipatthana Sutta. Is there one word that stands out to you in this reading? Well, yeah, knows. One knows. That's the key, isn't it? To me, this is the operative definition of mindfulness. One knows. When Bhikkhu Bodhi translated, this is Venerable Anālaya's translation, when Bhikkhu Bodhi translated this passage, he used one understands. So either way, one knows or one understands, it's a similar pointing. The Pali term that's being translated is pajanati. Pajanati is very closely related to the word sampajanya, which means clear comprehension. So you get that comprehension, knowing, understanding. Mindfulness is connected with knowing and understanding. Put very simply, and I'd like to offer this as our working definition, really throughout this whole retreat, because we'll come back to this a number of times. Mindfulness is knowing our present moment experience. The parenthesis is, that's in the Buddha's language, which is the six sense bases, the five aggregates, something like that. Knowing one's present experience in the Buddha's frame of reference, in the Buddha's foundations. And I've heard lots of lengthy definitions that use terms like non-judgmental and fully accepting and without greed, aversion, or delusion. I think that's gilding a lily. And what we really need is this knowing our present moment experience. That's really simple, isn't it? And that's enough. The amazing thing is that it's so simple and it's enough. For in the same discourse, Majjhima 10, if you want to look again at your study guide, quote number 1, Bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. Knowing our experience in the present moment does all of that. How does it do that? Well, one of the ways we can understand how it does that is to look at the alternatives. What's the alternative to knowing our present experience? So there's a cartoon from the New Yorker that I like. It's in three panels. So the first panel shows someone working at their desk on a PC, typing away, reading the screen, working on the PC. And there's a thought bubble above their head that indicates their daydream. And the daydream is they're out on a golf course about to drive a ball. And of course the subtext is, that's really where I'd rather be. Then the next panel, the same person is out on the golf course about to drive a ball, and there's another thought bubble in their head, and that thought bubble is, they're at home making love to their partner in bed. And of course the subtext is, wow, that's really where I'd rather be. And then there's a third panel. And in the third panel, the same person is at home in bed making love with their partner, and there's another thought bubble, which is of being in their office working on their computer at their desk. These are the alternatives to mindfulness. So this cartoon really quite succinctly sums up the force of the distracted mind. Always somewhere else than where we are. And it's not necessarily that where we are is somewhere that's not good to be. But there's this distracting movement of attention that thinks that there's more somewhere else. This is the core of restlessness. Restlessness is really thinking there's something better somewhere else and leaning toward that. So when we're not connected to the present moment, take a look at where the mind goes. The attention goes into these distracting thoughts of past and future and planning and remembering and analyzing and rehearsing and conversations and so forth. What I think is sometimes not fully grokked by us in looking at this situation is the impact of those distracting thoughts. Because often, you know, in meditation we'll talk about, oh, you know, return from a distraction, bring the attention back into the present moment, it's just a distraction. It sounds fairly neutral. But take a close look in your meditation. When one of these distracting thoughts arises, is it emotionally neutral? It's not generally, is it? It wanders off into wanting or regret or blame or resentment or fear or insecurity. It wanders into places that have emotional charge. That's where our thinking is drawn. That's where our thoughts go. And so when we come back from a distraction like that, are we generally calmer than when we took off? No. Generally, these distracting thoughts stir us up. And so it's not just a matter that we're missing the present moment experience. We're giving up a present moment experience, which is generally okay, to get involved in some kind of extended fantasy about past or future that's generally emotionally tiring and stirring. So one of the beauties of mindfulness is that it saves us from those kind of disruptive and disturbing thoughts and emotions. The Buddha's term for getting lost in these unwholesome thought patterns is unwise attention. Unwise attention is that which leads into stirring up the unwholesome states of mind. Wise attention is that which wears down the disturbing states and leads to states that grow in the Dharma, that lead to our happiness and our wisdom. Attention to the present moment is one of those things that leads to our happiness and wisdom. So mindfulness is making a clear choice moment after moment to be in the present for our own welfare and ultimately the welfare of others, and pursuing the distracting thought trains is a choice to stir the mind up and bring forth unwholesome emotions. Shame, blame, regret, worry, anxiety, longing, fear, and so on. So we are really, as meditators, we are learning how to choose the wholesome moment after moment after moment with this devotion to mindfulness and this renunciation of all the thought excursions. So, of course, we can't control that by an act of will, right? We may have tried for a long time. These thoughts will continue to arise, and sometimes we'll jump on the train. But we can tune into how does that feel afterwards. When we've been on the train for a while, we will come back to the present moment. How has it felt to be on the train? How does it feel to be back here? And this is how we learn, moment by moment, what leads to our suffering, what leads to our happiness and contentment. So within the overall field of mindfulness, the Buddha emphasized mindfulness of the body a lot. So it's the first foundation in the Satipatthana Sutta. In the Anguttara Nikaya, there's one point where there are 50 discourses in a row in praise of mindfulness of the body. 50 in a row, and here's just one. When one thing is developed and cultivated, the body becomes tranquil, the mind becomes tranquil, extraneous thoughts subside, and all wholesome qualities that pertain to true knowledge reach fulfillment. What is that one thing? Mindfulness directed to the body. Unwholesome qualities decline, and the qualities that lead to true knowledge arise. I find it really interesting that the Buddha puts so much emphasis on mindfulness of the body, because when you get down to it, our meditation is all about the mind. We're not freeing the body. It's going to do what it's going to do. Our goal is to free the mind. So that's why so much emphasis is on states of mind, like the hindrances, greed, aversion, delusion, craving, clinging, and then the wholesome mental states, the seven factors of awakening, the five spiritual faculties, the Brahmaviharas. These are all qualities of mind. It's mental cultivation that we're about. Why then is there so much emphasis on the body? So here are a few reasons. Mindfulness of the body has been probably my central practice over all the years I've been involved in meditation, and here's why I found it so helpful. It's always available. Like it or not, the body's always here. So it gives often a very clear experience that we can pay attention to. And it's very valuable in that way. Also, the Buddha said if you're going to identify with something, if you're going to say, I am this, he said it's much better to identify with the body than with the mind. Why? Because the mind changes so much more rapidly. You know, in the course of a few breaths, you can go from here to around the world, on a vacation and having your baggage lost and meeting your soulmate in a remote airport and come back to here in a few seconds. But the body stayed right here. Because of that relative stability, and it's only relative, the body's changing, cells are being born and dying, subject to illness, aging and death. But relatively, compared to the mind, it's more stable. So you feel this in meditation as you sit still, as we sit still in our meditation posture. That stability and stillness in the body transmits something to the mind. It transmits a sense of groundedness. And in a way, what we're doing is we're taking our seat and the emotional waves come and go. Sometimes they crash like big breakers against a rocky cliff. Sometimes they're smooth, very pleasant. But we sit through all that wave activity because the body is still. And that says something. It says to the mind, I can be with this. So the body ends up being, despite its vulnerability and being subject to pain, ends up being a grounding place and a source of stability and balance. Ajahn Buddhadasa, who I spent quite a bit of time with in Thailand, had a nice saying. He said, don't do anything that takes you out of the body. Stay in touch with the body all the time. Now, I want to acknowledge, because it's a reality, the body may not be inviting at times. If you've had past trauma that's stored in the body, if you have a lot of physical pain, if you have an injury, if you have an illness, it's not so pleasant to bring the attention into the body again and again and again and again. And then you'll need to figure out, you'll need to find your way of how to connect with the body at times and how to open to something more neutral, perhaps to sound, perhaps to images, perhaps to space at other times. Work with your teacher to find a way to work with that kind of situation. But if the body is relatively okay, it's very good for grounding. Also, being in touch with the body keeps us in touch with our emotions. If there's a strong emotion going on, we'll feel it in the body. When the mind is agitated, the body's usually agitated. When the mind is calm, the body's usually calm. So sometimes we may not be so in touch with the subtlety of emotional movement, but if we check in with the body, we can recognize agitation or calm. And trust that, because as the books say, the body doesn't lie. The body keeps the score. You know, it's real. So when there's agitation in the body, take a look. What's going on in the mind? Sometimes you'll find it's old karma playing out in the body and not actually an agitation arising from present moment mind activity. But sometimes it's present moment. But even if it's old karma, there's often mental agitation with the physical agitation, even if it's old karma. So, mindfulness in general, mindfulness of the body, and finally, mindfulness of breathing. The primary practice in 2,500 years of Vipassana. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. This is in quote 2 from the Anapanasati Sutta in your study guide. You know, even after the Buddha was enlightened, he kept going on retreat. I found this so interesting. All his afflictive emotions had been uprooted. He wasn't suffering. And yet he still went into retreat, sometimes for 3 months at a stretch. And on one of these three-month retreats, he practiced mindfulness of breathing the whole time. And he came out and he told the monastics, if anyone could say of anything that it is a noble dwelling, a divine dwelling, the Tathagata's dwelling, it is of concentration by mindfulness of breathing that one would rightly say this. That's high praise. If it was good enough for the Buddha for 3 months, it's good enough for us for 10 days. So why is breath such a useful focus? So one of the reasons, I want to list a number because they are special qualities of this focus. One of the reasons is that it happens by itself. It's part of the semi-autonomous nervous system, so we don't have to do anything to make it happen. That means we can relax. And in the long run, we learn to have that relaxing turn into resting. We can rest in a very receptive frame of mind, let the breath come and go, and provide a clear focus for wise attention. Breath also is always there. You can always find it on a meditation cushion, when walking, when doing the dishes, when eating food at home, preparing a meal. It's always there. So it's a reliable companion. Another great strength is it's basically neutral. So it's not going to be hugely provoking of desire or aversion. Basically neutral. So it's kind of easy to be with something that's neutral. But it has the potential for a lot of pleasure. And this takes some practice, but the potential is there. First thing we notice with the breath as we're in the good relationship with it, there's an absence of disturbing thoughts. So there's a quality of peace that accompanies being with the breath. As we get familiar with the relaxation that Sally was talking about this morning, and the sense of ease and comfort that can come with the breath, that creates a very pleasant feeling. So that's the opening to the pleasure of the breath, is that sense of relaxation and ease. Once we find that in our meditation, that becomes a real motivation. We stop resisting the meditation. You know, we know it's good for us, but you know, we don't really want to do it. But when this pleasure element comes in, we kind of want to do it. And that will bring us back more and more and more to undertaking the practice. And this pleasure is not just, you know, a nice feeling. It's onward leading. Pleasure, the Pali term is sukha, which sounds like sugar. And it has the sweetness of sugar. And it's said that this kind of pleasure, which includes relaxation and ease and contentment, is the proximate cause for concentration to arise. And I'm sure you all know how that works. When you start feeling easy in the moment and can deeply relax into your body and into the moment, you don't want to be anywhere else. So this sort of habitual restlessness of looking elsewhere for satisfaction or gratification or to ward off the difficult can rest, can relax. And just dropping into that ease brings contentment. And it's that contentment that allows the mind to collect and unify the way Sally was describing it this morning in the meditation instructions. The other thing that is beautiful about the breath is its natural rhythm. Again, when we're learning to let go of past and future and coming into the present, letting the breath be natural, letting it come and go on its own, it finds a very easy rhythm. We're not controlling it. In that natural rhythm, we find there's a calm that comes from it. The rhythm itself is calming, is soothing. And I'm speculating a little bit, but I wonder if some of that soothing quality of the breath's rhythm is that it takes us back to being on our mother's chest when we were babies and feeling that rise and fall, in that position of absolute safety and nourishment. That's what it makes me think of, anyway, back at my mother's breast. So we want to open up and allow the breath to find its natural rhythm, but that's not so easy. As Sally mentioned this morning, it's always not so easy to relax in meditation or outside. So when I first got into mindfulness of breathing, I would notice that I would be controlling the breath more or less all the time. And there would be this little signal. It wasn't so much verbal, but it was, now breathe, now breathe out, now breathe, now breathe out. And I would sort of be telling myself when to breathe in and breathe out. And I was following some rhythm that was an idea in my head. So it took a while to trust and relax enough to let go of that. So in the beginning, as you're with the breath, if you find a little bit of control coming in, don't worry about it. It's something that will fade as the relaxation deepens. So you don't have to fight it. To say, stop controlling. It's just another form of controlling. So it'll come with the relaxation. The other great thing that's wonderful about paying attention to the breath, it has its own balance. And that is the in-breath feels one way and the out-breath feels another way. So tune into this. This becomes interesting to investigate. How does it feel when you breathe in? How does it feel when you breathe out? So take a look at this word, pana. You know, it's anapana, in and out breathing. Pana is the Pali term. You know what the Sanskrit is? Prana. It's not just a clothing line. But prana is an ancient yogic term that denotes the in-breath, but it has connotations of the life force and energy. What keeps us going is prana or pana. So you'll feel that as you get quiet. You can feel how each in-breath picks up the energy. You can feel it ripple throughout the body. It energizes, it wakes us up, it lifts us up, and then the out-breath lets it all go. On the out-breath, we empty. Going out into space, the mind settles. Let go, relax. So the uplift and the outgo are both there in one breath. A beautiful balance of energy. Another thing that's powerful about mindfulness of breathing is that once we make a commitment to this kind of focus, it very clearly shows us what's not with this focus. So as you get connected to the breath and its rhythm, when you go away from it for any period of time, and you come back, it's really obvious. I wasn't with the breath. It may be just 2 seconds or 3 seconds, but it's very obvious. We were somewhere else for those 3 seconds. It's interesting because in doing an open practice like choiceless attention, which we'll touch on later in the retreat, a lot of people love to do choiceless attention because it's not hard work. Being with the breath is hard work. When we're with choiceless attention, often thoughts will drift through and we won't even notice them. But there will often be kind of a subconscious line of thinking that is actually stealing our present moment attention, and we hardly notice because we're just open. So when we commit to a focus, then what's not of that focus stands out really clearly. And we see the mind's movements and we see the mind's habitual tendencies very clearly. There's a funny thing I want to put in right here. Committing to a focus takes some courage, takes some discipline, takes some energy, takes some ardor. And Ajahn Suchito made an interesting kind of ironic comment about it. He said, anytime you commit to a focus, craving is going to come in. I find this really true. Because we're going to find things we like, and we're going to find things that are difficult in that focus. I'll touch on that again a little later. Another great thing about the breath is it's the wind element. It's an elemental kind of practice. You know, the Buddha talked about four elements, earth, water, fire, and wind. And here we're with the wind element, you know, possibly all day long. So we start to realize the body is made up of the natural elements of solidity, of fluidity or cohesion, of warmth or coolness, and of movement or wind. So we start to realize the connection between the body and the whole material world. This body has the same elements as the whole material world. And this is our moment-by-moment experience of the wind element. It gets interesting to kind of investigate self and not self with the wind element. So when air comes in, it comes in from outside, so it's not me. And then it comes into the nose. Is it me yet? And it goes into the lungs, and then the oxygen attaches to the blood particles. Now is it me? Okay, now it's in the blood, now it's me. And then it goes to the body, and the oxygen gets used, and then it comes to the lungs again, and then the wind gets filled with carbon dioxide. Is that me? And then it gets breathed out, and then is it not me? So we start to realize we're porous to the world. There's no firm barrier, even between the body and the world, much less between me and not me. The other beautiful thing about mindfulness of the breath is the Buddha said it fulfills all four foundations of mindfulness. This is pretty interesting, and I would encourage you to look at your study guide again, if you have it, in quotation 2, on page 2. So, you know, the second foundation is feeling tone. So in the bracketed section that's in the middle, indented, you'll see a line that says, I shall breathe in or out experiencing pleasure. So here we have pleasant feeling tone, pleasant vedana, coming in as a result of the breath. So we're into the second foundation of mindfulness through the breath. And then a little further on, you'll see the line, the next stanza, I shall breathe in or out, gladdening the mind. Gladness of mind is in the third foundation. It's a state of mind. It's part of citta. So here, mindfulness of breathing is satisfying the third foundation of mindfulness. What is the mind state when breathing in? What is the mind state when breathing out? And then in the final stanza, I shall breathe in or out contemplating impermanence. Impermanence is part of the fourth foundation. It's ground for insight, wisdom. So here, mindfulness of breathing is fulfilling the fourth foundation. So all four foundations are complete, can be complete, within mindfulness of breathing. That's a powerful commonality, powerful statement. So these are some of the things that are so rich about mindfulness of the breath and why it's worth spending 10 days or 3 months practicing, learning, and developing this. There are many ways to approach relating to the breath. Sally gave beginning instructions this morning. We will offer many other alternative approaches over the days to come. Where to be with the breath in the body, whether to use noting or counting, whether to combine the breath with different parts of the body. There are many, many ways to approach it. And all of them are fine in this context. In the context of these 10 days of retreat, they're all fine. So we're not going to tell you you have to practice being with the breath in this particular way, but hope to offer some alternatives so that you find the way that works best for you. And I just wanted to relate one kind of fun experience I had with mindfulness of breathing a couple of months ago. We were over at a friend's house for dinner. And this friend was playing with one of these headbands that acts like an EEG. It monitors your brain waves and transmits the results to your phone. And if you get into a certain groove, it can tell whether you're in a calm state. It can tell if you're in a neutral state. It can tell if you're in an activated state. So for meditation purposes, this is used to train to be in a calm state. So I had never heard of anything like this. I didn't know there was such a thing. You can buy it on Amazon and pair it with an iPhone or an Android phone. So my friend put it on me, turned on his phone, and the other three people sat around watching me meditate for 5 minutes to see if I was going to be calm or active or what. And the cool thing about, I thought it was cool, about the app is you, if you get into a calm state, it plays bird songs on the app. And the bird songs are such positive reinforcement, you really want to make the bird songs happen. And so I tried a few different kinds of meditation, and none of them were really producing many bird songs. And so I went to the nose, and I put all my attention on the sensations in my nose with in and out breathing, and the birds just went crazy. And I could sustain it for a while, but the app gave me a score of 80% at the end, which was kind of gratifying. But I could see how something like that could train me through repetition to really get into a strong relationship or get into a real groove with the mindfulness of breathing. And then a distracting thought came up at one point near the end. The birds went away. Oh, it's so disappointing. But I knew what I had to do to get them back. So it is fun. These kind of tools are out there. And I wasn't so interested in using it to train my mind because I practiced a lot of this kind of breathing. But just to remember what it feels like to really be on, to be in the breath, and really giving all one's attention to it in the present moment. And it did do that. Okay, so those are the beautiful things about the breath. And I also want to acknowledge there are some real difficulties with the breath, some of which apply to all of us, some of which apply to specific situations. So I just want to mention these briefly, and encourage you to talk with us, with Sally and me, if you run into these. So, the breath may not be a good focus for everyone. And what makes it not a good focus for some people is if there's a history of trauma or injury or illness in the chest or around breathing. Then the repeated attention to that part of the body or to the breath can reactivate that trauma or that past injury. So, for example, if someone has had asthma in the past and has felt themselves struggling to breathe, then being with the breath in that close a way may remind them of the struggle to breathe, and it may be counterproductive. It may be something the person can work through, or it may be that another option would be a better option for them. So this is why it's helpful to talk with your teacher about it. So that it could come from an illness like asthma, it could come from a past injury or a trauma connected with the area of breathing. Then another focus might be more skillful. Talk with your teacher and see. And then, as Ajahn Suchito said, if we commit to a certain practice, we're going to run into craving. And there's a particular name for the craving that comes from meditating. It's called striving. And striving means that you felt something nice in your meditation and you want it back. Because all the nice things that happen in meditation do pass, right? You know that. No state of mind is lasting. The beautiful states of meditation also pass, but we want them back. So very common in doing some days of concentration practice with the breath that you will find yourself in very satisfying states of peace, of calm, of contentment, of settledness, of ease, where the mindfulness is effortless for, you know, periods of time. It might be 30 seconds, it might be 30 minutes. But you may find yourself in these situations. And then it will change, as everything does. And the next time you come and sit, you might want it back. Just coincidentally, you might want it back. And then you might try really hard to make it happen again. Oh, I can't let these thoughts come in. I've really got to bear down and not miss a single breath. And that will rev up this state of concentration again. And of course, this forgets how we got there in the first place, which is by relaxing. We forget that relaxing and accepting was the way into that. And we strive really hard to reproduce it by working harder and getting tenser. So when I was practicing in Burma with Paok Sayadaw, I fell into this kind of over and over. And I would go to see him every day in the afternoon for an interview. And he knew I was a meditation teacher in the States, so I felt I had a little bit of an image to keep up. But I also had to just be honest with him. And I said, Sayadaw, I've really found I'm striving in my practice. Do you have any advice for me? And I thought, after all his years of helping beginning meditators, you know, through all the hurdles of concentration practice, where they're deeply committed, he would have just the wisest thing to say. And so he replied, don't do that. And that was it. So I had to go back to my kuti and find out for myself how not to do that, which I got better at not doing. But it was a lot of learning. And then another way that we can get caught is judging ourselves when we're doing a concentration practice. We can get caught thinking we're not doing it well enough. Oh, I'm not good enough. You know, I was with the breath for a few breaths and then I was away for 10 minutes on this chain of thoughts about something that happened last week before I came here. It was 10 minutes before I could come out of it and come back to the breath. That's terrible. I'll never get anywhere with this meditation. Not helpful. So first of all, I mean, this is a very common thing to have happen for all of us. I've been there many times myself. The first thing that's really out of joint with it is we think we have some idea of how long we should be away. Oh, if I was a good meditator, I wouldn't be away 10 minutes. Well, how long would you be away? What's the right length of time for a good meditator to be away? Is it like never? No. Is it like one breath? No. I mean, get real. So we have this standard that we think we have to meet, but we have no idea what the standard is or where it came from. And it's just replaying our habitual tendency to find fault with ourselves. So beware of that. If it happens to you, ask yourself, what's the right length of time to be away? There's no answer to that. You all are experienced practitioners. Every one of you has lots of meditative background and experience and confidence. You wouldn't be here if the practice hadn't been of tremendous benefit to you. You wouldn't come for a month. It's been of tremendous benefit, therefore it has already worked. Therefore, you're already a good meditator. So take yourself as the standard. I'm a good meditator and I'm away for 10 minutes. Well, that's what happens for good meditators. That's just fine. That's just fine. The growing freedom is when we realize that we've been away, we make the choice to come back. We say, that wasn't so helpful. Oh, let me connect again to the present. Let me connect again to feeling the breath. That's where the freedom starts to come. Okay, there's another whole set of problems connected with our relationship with thoughts. But I don't want to get in. It's a little long for our remaining time. So I'm going to end here for tonight. And I'll just close with this quotation from the Samyutta Nikaya. Mindfulness of breathing is peaceful and sublime. It is an abiding in happiness that breaks up and calms unwholesome mental states whenever they arise. So that's our potential. So let's just sit for a minute together, let the words settle.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.